Okay, and welcome. Now I'm going to share screen for some of the questions. So here we have a submission about a female, 50 years old, hot flashes and night sweats are chief complaints. Signs and symptoms are about 6 hot flashes per day and 3 night sweats that wake her up every night. All started about 1 month ago and is very intense and disruptive to her sleep and her day. So immediately I'm thinking about, with hot flashes, wanting to know her age, which is 50 here, and knowing the average menopausal period being 51 or 52 on average, we're right in that time. I'd be interested to understand a little more, and we're getting a little more here. She's entering menopause, of course. She has a very recent blood test from her doctor showing estradiol is normal at less than 15, progesterone normal at 4.5. Now, what I don't know is, has she had a full year without periods? If she has, then she's fully into menopause. If she's not, then she may be in perimenopause. So that would be an important distinction, because the transition tends to change a little bit during that period after the year mark. So that's a helpful thing to know. So estradiol less than 15, I'd imagine with that rate, she's probably not cycling. Now, the question is, how long has she been not cycling? Progesterone of 4.5. Okay. Non-serving diet, lifestyle, and or mindset issues. She drinks wine some evenings with dinner, not excessive, maybe 1 to 2 glasses with the meal. Otherwise, she follows a clean diet with few cheats here and there. Exercises, sleeps well apart from waking up lately with night sweats. How much does stress play a role? Not super stressful life, sometimes a little hectic, but no major stress. Mental, emotional, spiritual dynamics at play? No. Other pertinent information, histories, obstacles to treatment, things that are going well. So she did have estrogen dominance in the spring, treated it with DIM and Chasetree. Her cycle has been irregular for the past 2 years and now seems to have stopped completely. Her last cycle was in August. Okay, here we go. So we have August until December, September, October, November, December. That's about 4 months. So she's in the perimenopause window, which naturally there will be some changes in that year period. And so hot sweats that are new like this aren't nearly as concerning as ones that have been going on for years, for example. Plan is to reduce caffeine. She doesn't have much alcohol and sugar. She has fruit and raw honey or homemade paleo type baked things sometimes. And read that black cohosh, Vitex, 5-HTP can all be helpful. Planning to look into how to use these and in what combination. So, what we'd like to look at here is one thing I want to just be training you guys to do is, there's some great resources inside of the course, where when you go to the quick treatment guides, you should be able to find some things under reproductive hormones. And when we look at menopause, perimenopause section, we're going to see right here there are some treatment considerations. Often a decline in both progesterone and estrogen. Progesterone can decline more quickly than estrogen and set the stage for estrogen dominance. Now, we already see here that estrogen dominance was an issue previously, and it was being treated with DIM and Chasetree. DIM to bring estrogen down, Chasetree to bring progesterone up. So we may want to continue on the Chasetree for a longer period of time. I'm not sure how long Chasetree was being supplemented for, but it would be reasonable to continue it. then estrogen's cardio and bone protective. Cortisol levels tend to increase, especially at night for menopausal women. That can contribute to hot flashes and night sweats. So since we know cortisol levels tend to increase, we have the stress question here. Not a very stressful life, sometimes a little hectic, but no major stress. That doesn't mean that there's not having a cortisol rise. So in some cases, we may want to take a look at cortisol and see what it's doing in the evening. In other cases, we may want to trial meditation practice or Epsom salt baths or a breathing exercise before bed or some phosphatidylserine before bed as something that may be helpful, because we do see that hot flash and night sweat contribution from the raising cortisol. And then there's a little bit of research about vaginal pH. And then here are some of the initial things that we can think of. So flaxseed has been shown to decrease menopausal symptoms without decreasing estrogen levels. 40 grams per day of flax shows significant reduction in hot flashes. And typically with flax, I like the ground version. It tends to, I find, have a little bit better of an effect than the whole seeds. Probably digests and metabolizes a little better and gets that mechanism of action, which are the phytoestrogens in flax, able to bind to the estrogen receptors so that you're getting some extra estrogen in addition to what's present. It's weaker than endogenous estrogen, but it is going to have an effect on those receptor sites and potentially help to a large degree with having a significant reduction in hot flashes. It's been shown to be antiestrogenic and work with breast cancer patients. So safe with breast cancer patients, even though it's got phytoestrogens, it also has antiestrogenic in a sense, because that weaker phytoestrogen bound to a receptor can block more sort of estrogenic endogenous molecules. So it works both ways for low or high estrogen. It's adaptogenic in a sense. Pumpkin seeds can be great for menopausal women. 2 grams per day of pumpkin seed oil showed significant reduction in hot flashes. And they also have zinc content, blood sugar regulation, fiber content. So that can be added to a protocol as pumpkin seed or pumpkin seed oil. Wheat germ oil, obviously it's going to depend on if there's a celiac or severe gluten sensitivity. We may not want to use even wheat germ oil. There's very little gluten, but there could be some. Has a reputation for reducing hot flashes, but when they did trials and they compared it to pumpkin seeds work better, and we don't have that gluten issue there. So we have flaxseed and pumpkin seed, which are going to be helpful. Also, just so you have an understanding of some easy ways to go do some research, I want to, you know, a lot of these things I know offhand, but sometimes I like to go, even if I know offhand that I want to do some chaste tree, I want to add some ground flaxseed and pumpkin seed or pumpkin seed oil into the diet. I want to do some black cohosh to help increase those estrogen levels. We want to reduce alcohol and sugar. Even though we know all that already, we may want to look at adrenal hormones as well, gut health as well, all those other staples of functional medicine, especially gut and adrenals, are going to be really important to look at in the reproductive hormone areas. So those are going to be really important to look at. Toxin exposure, because so many toxins are endocrine disrupting. And so we do want to look at toxin exposure and potentially some detoxification support and or binders. So in addition to all of that, some additional things that we can look at and resources. One good one is Green Med Info. So if we go to Green Med Info and we type in hot flashes, we're going to see for that symptom what research papers have targeted that symptom. And we're going to see different substances, and we're going to see how many citations there were and a ranking of how strong those citations were, and then a list of those citations so that we can take a look at those studies and see the degree to which they're helpful. So we see black cohosh here. We see several things, like we already talked about flaxseed. Genistein is a substance that comes from soy. And so if we click, for example, here, we're going to see extract, pycnogenol. So we see a list of things, 36 abstracts with hot flash research. Genistein comes up in some of that research and is significant. So when we look at this study here, for example, we can see the abstract shows us that we evaluated and compared the effects of the phytoestrogen, genistein, estrogen, progesterone therapy, and placebo on hot flashes. By comparison with placebo, daily flushes reduced significantly by a mean of 22% after 3 months, a mean of 29% after 6 months, and a mean of 24% after 12 months of genistein treatment. It reduced by 53% after 3 months, 56% after 6 months, and by a mean of 54% after 12 months of estrogen progesterone treatment. So here we can see that estrogen progesterone treatment reduced by a mean of 54%, whereas genistein reduced by a mean of 24%. So we will get, maybe a 24-quarter reduction just from genistein without the use of estrogen progesterone. But we may want to use something like, for example, Bezuecan. So if we go to Natural Partners and we look up Bezuecan, we can see that we have the Phyto-B L4X, and the Phyto-B is the one that contains both estriol and estradiol and progesterone. And it's a nice mix. I like the ratios of these. And it's 10 drops of oil. It can be applied topically or taken internally, because even though the package won't say internally, when we look at the ingredients, we see that it's in a rice bran oil, coconut oil base, which is a safe base for ingestion with vitamin E. So we do use this both for ingestion and for topical. So this is something that we can look at, especially for temporary relief when we see how significant the 56% reduction after 3 months. But we may want to look at some other strategies for long-term reduction so that we don't have to stay on replacement hormones for a long period of time. Or we can first try something like flaxseed and genistein and a few other things to see the degree to which we can get reduction together with lifestyle changes like alcohol and diet, and that should be able to give us a sense. So we can look at black cohosh and see that black cohosh here was also effective. We can find a black cohosh study that was published in 2008. We can look at that study and get a sense for the percentage of people and the, and this is the abstract. If you need the whole study itself, and you can always go to PMID. Some studies, full text, are readily available. Others aren't. Some people choose to use Sci-Hub, which will give full text for a lot of studies, even if they aren't available. Everyone has their own ethics about that. So I'll let you choose for yourself whether you would use Sci-Hub. But at the very minimum, you can use these extracts. You can look at the PubMed article. It has links out, and it also has where you can look at the publications. So that's something that I want you guys to know of. Another good resource is Examine. And you go to Examine and you type in hot flashes, you're going to see some things come up. So we see black cohosh comes up. Now you're going to see here that we have some things like it shows symptoms of menopause are minorly decreased by black cohosh. It's very highly correlated in research, and there are 13 studies. And the magnitude of the benefit may not be so great. So we can look at the studies and we can see, and it's going to, you know, hide some of the studies, but I'll go ahead and log in so we can see more of the studies here because I do have an account. So I'll need to open up my password manager to get in. We'll be able to see the full list. So then we can look at all 13 studies and we can scroll through and see the different studies, how long they were they double blind, were body types overweight or average, and it's going to give us a better sense. Then we can go to a study, we can see the abstract, and then we could pull the full text if it's freely available, or use Sci-Hub if we wanted to. And then symptoms of menopause here, we can click and we can just see for that symptom, what things do we see altogether? Panax ginseng showed a minor reduction. Pararia morifica showed a notable reduction with very high correlation. Only four studies, so the confidence factor, the level of evidence is a little less, but we did see a more notable reduction. So we may want to look a little bit at those studies, and then we can look and see if we have that available as a supplement. So then we might bring that over to Emerson or Natural Partners or Zymogen, and we might type it in and see, do we have it available? And then we can look at, oh, well, this Estro PX, maybe it has that in it. Let's take a look. And so I'm not sure why this one popped up because I don't see. So red clover. Yeah, I'm not sure why that one popped up. But anyway, that's something that we can do. Pycnogenol has some minor reduction in a study. So here's where we can see another perspective of cataloged studies that are going to show some reductions. We also can go to Zymogen, and they have a product called Flash Arrest. And we can look at this product targeting estrogen activity for men and women. We can see it's got Norway spruce lignin extract, and it's got a hops extract, and we can always look at the doctor reference sheet to see what research they're pulling off of. And we have a bunch of references here. We have some summaries of studies here, and it shows that 8PN had maybe more potent phytoestrogen effects as compared to certain other ones. So whereas flaxseed and or genistein may give good phytoestrogen effects, this may give a more potent phytoestrogen effect. So we can look at something like the Flash Arrest and look at the studies here and get a sense. So again, I want to kind of try and help you guys to get a sense for how to think through these more than me just telling you a protocol. Here I will mention what I would do in terms of a protocol, but I want to also give you the way to think through, do a little research. And you can do this fairly quickly. I mean, we've spent a little bit of time here, but it doesn't have to take this much time. And especially as you do the same issues over and over again, you'll know your go-to things that are helpful and you won't have to do quite as much research. But you can pull open the quick treatment guide, get a sense, flaxseed, pumpkin seed are probably two that we want to do, black cohosh that we want to do. We may look at something like flash arrest, and we may look at something like a Bezwecken or other hormone replacement, or, you know, could be compounded prescription hormone replacement as well. But we might look at something progesterone estrogen replacement therapy as well as a bioidentical, especially during that perimenopause period. And then when we get to about the year mark, we may reduce off of that and see if we can sustain through just diet and lifestyle. So let's go ahead and stop share for a moment here. So I'm going to pull open a whiteboard so we can go over some of the specific suggestions and some things that didn't pull open in that research that would also be helpful, because there are always mechanisms that are not going to go in the same way just by looking at a symptom that's been cataloged by, for example, some of the places like GreenMedInfo and Examine. Those are reasonable places to start, but sometimes that doesn't get to the root cause, right? It oftentimes will do something like begin the process of getting you a sense for the root cause. Like, low estrogen might be part of the issue, but is that the root? Why did the estrogen become low? And we need to go more upstream in order sometimes to get to deeper root causes, because we know that gut is connected to things like the reproductive hormone system, and we know toxins are endocrine disruptors, and we want to kind of get a sense for the ability to be able to do more than just look at the herbs that treat an issue. That's kind of an allopathic way of thinking, drug for a symptom or herb for a symptom. Instead, we want to ideally move in the direction of going more towards the idea of upstream root causes that can lead later to later root causes that can lead to symptoms. So, for example, a gut issue may lead to an increase in beta-glucuronidase enzyme, may lead to a breaking apart of the glucuronide bond from estrogen, breakdown in the liver, may lead to estrogen issues with estrogen disposal, may lead to increases in sex hormone binding globulin, and so on and so forth. So we want to look at those bigger issues, and that is going to have some significant impacts way beyond just throwing supplements at issues, especially when you can combine, you can kind of target more the you can target more the same root causes for multiple symptoms and reduce supplements that people are on and protocols that people are on to core issues. That can be really helpful for people. So a lot of times I don't even end up needing to use black cohosh or genistein or flash arrest or hormone replacement. Many times I'm able to, through gut work, through toxin work, and those are the primary two, is gut and toxins, sometimes adrenals and stress, regulate, plus diet and lifestyle, regulate the underlying root cause issues to where we don't need to use those other things. So the first thing to think about is, have we done SIBO breath testing? Have we looked at a stool test like a GI map or doctor's data, CDSA with parasitology times four? Have we treated and resolved those issues that came up there? Have we looked at history and seen whether toxic burden might be a case? Have we looked at any lab testing like metals testing or mold mycotoxin testing that might point us towards there being an issue with their having an excess of toxin exposure? Have we added detoxification compounds and or binders? These are going to be some of the most significant things. And then have we looked at stress? Because norepinephrine, which is also called noradrenaline, is one of the big triggers for hot flashes, and even more so for night sweats. And often women really think that their hot flashes and night sweats come from estrogen being low, and a lot of doctors do too, but norepinephrine and, you know, cortisol and stress is huge. And adrenal support, especially the calming kind, like adaptogenic herbs, phosphatidylserine, magnesium, vitamin C, can be really impactful for night sweats, even though it's not sort of directly researched or looking at night sweats. Again, it's one of those upstream things. And we could, of course, test and see on like a Dutch adrenals or a Dutch complete or a Dutch plus, how's that hormone cycling? How are those, you know, cortisol levels? But we may even still miss norepinephrine levels, and norepinephrine may be causing those hot flashes. So that's something to keep in mind in this particular case, is the upstream part of what we're doing. So let's get out the whiteboard here. Okay, so So here we have female, 50 years old. Hot flashes and night sweats. We want to think root causes. And we have on the list here, low estrogen, norepinephrine. We have gut dysbiosis, toxic burden. And then we have testing possibilities. We can look at a Dutch adrenal or plus. We can look at organic acids for a sense on liver detoxification. We can look at metals. We can look at HLA, DR, and TGF. Beta 1 on the mold side of things. We can look at SIBO breath test, GI MAP stool test, and NutriVal would also potentially be inclusive of the organic acids, but some additional nutrient markers. I would say that probably I would highlight the gut ones and toxins here as being prominently helpful tests. Then let's take a look at supplements direct for symptoms, and we can look at Phyto B L4X by Bezweken, and that would be dosed typically we could do 8 drops 3 times a day or 12 drops BID. And I usually prefer oral on that, and that's a good place to start. We can look at flaxseed. The study said 40 grams per day. Usually a tablespoon, if it's heaping, is going to be at least 9-10 grams. So we could do something like 2 tablespoons twice daily. Ground flaxseed would be a great one to do. I'm not going to put genistein separately because it's a similar mechanism of action, and it's soy, and soy is a little more immunogenic and a little more likely to have side effect or byproduct. So I'm going to leave it with flaxseed on the phytoestrogen unless we want to use the flash arrest. And if we want to use the flash arrest, which we could use and would be potentially as strong or stronger if someone didn't want to do quite that much flaxseed, it was hard for them to get in, we might do 1 cap twice daily on the flash arrest, or we could do 2 caps before bed to target sleeping time specifically. Then we may want to do something herbal along the lines of black cohosh and or herbal formula containing this. And there's some great Chinese herbal formulas. I know most people watching this may not thoroughly understand Chinese herbal formulas or want to do them, but the Romania formulas on the Chinese medicine side, so Romania 6 is the name of a formula that is particularly helpful, and there are variations on it that have a little more heat clearing. So Romania 6 or or variations on this base formula are really, really helpful on the Chinese medicine side of things. Then supplements for root causes. So we could look at something on the stress. I'm just going to say treatments because we're going to go into a little more detail here. So we're going to say meditation practice, breathing techniques, Epsom salt baths, phosphatidylserine, and that would be about 300 milligrams before bed. And then we may want to look at any other things that the person subjectively feels that calm them down. It could be avoiding electronics. It could be going for a walk outside. It could be massage with a loved one. There are lots of different ways of managing and regulating that stress response and reducing the norepinephrine levels. Reduced alcohol intake. And then I'm going to mention a few additional things like glycine can reduce body temp at night and help with sleep. So 3 grams at bedtime may be helpful. The chili pad, or they have another version that's even a little better than the chili pad, but most people know it by the chili pad, can help reduce temp at night, and that can help with sleep and reduce symptoms of hot flash. Generally, 63 to 67 ambient temperature is best researched for optimal sleep. So the chili pad gives a lot of granular control over that. Some people can get fairly reasonable control with thermostats and editing blankets and things like that. So that would be another thing to consider as well in this case. Then treatments for root causes. We may also want to look at gut treatments and things that might be helpful for the gut. I'm not going to go over those here because we train on those so well in the program, but testing for and treating gut issues would be key in this case. Toxin side of things, I think it's reasonable to look at detoxification supplements proactively, even without a lot of lab testing. So liver detox steps, and that's going to be things like NAC, ALA, glutathione, milk thistle, extract, cholagogues, so herbs that are like artichoke and other things that stimulate the bile, glycine, etc. So there are going to be a lot of things in that category. You can get a combo product, or you can look at individual products in that case. So liver detox steps would be another thing to consider in this case. So we have quite a lot that we can do here. So hopefully this gives you a sense not only for what to do, but how to think about what to do. And that should be helpful in your process for not only treating this case, but also looking in the future. At how to think through some of these things. So, next. Case. Female, 37 years old, tired, mood swings, migraines, headaches, hypothyroid. Tired and other symptoms above, reports severe fatigue in the afternoon and evening, has difficulty falling and staying asleep. New client for me, so I don't have loads of info. Her diet can be improved, so we're working on that. She has two small children and works. I am sure of mind and environmental issues. I'm not sure of mind or environmental issues. She has a six-month-old baby and a three-year-old. Very little time to herself, currently on maternity leave, but normally works full time. 6 or 7 out of 10 for stress playing a role. Don't think that stress and busyness, anything aside from that, mentally, emotionally, spiritually. Hypothyroid intakes levothyroxine. Okay, so we have a 37-year-old, tired, moon swings, migraines, headaches, and hypothyroid. So, first thing is immediately on hypothyroid, just because we see 20 to 40% of people with hypothyroid having parietal cell antibodies, we'll want to look at that. So this is female, 37 years old. With a chief complaint of fatigue, hypothyroid, mood swings and migraine headaches. So then we're going to look at lab testing. Antiparietal cell antibodies, or APCA, very inexpensive, easy to get test, often covered by insurance. If not, it's not expensive whatsoever. Those are going to be important because in at least 20% of thyroid, hypothyroid cases, we see positive antiparietal cell antibody titers. And if those are positive, those are going to lead to lower hydrochloric acid production, which means lower absorption of nutrients and digestion of important amino acids and minerals. And minerals are important cofactors for thyroid. Selenium, zinc, iodine, these are really important for thyroid function. Parietal cell antibodies will lower our ability to absorb those things, because of lowered stomach acid. Parietal cell antibodies also produce intrinsic factors, so vitamin B12 won't absorb or metabolize. So we'll want vitamin B12 injections, and that can be a direct cause of fatigue, independent of thyroid, but comorbid condition together with thyroid in many cases. And so I would strongly recommend antiparietal cell antibodies if positive. Weekly vitamin B12 injections of at least 1 milligram, better 5 or 10 milligrams, better methylcobalamin or hydroxylcobalamin are the best forms. So that would be weekly for at least 12 weeks, then retest. May take a long time, could take 3 weeks to a year or more, depending on how high those parietal cell antibody levels are, but should show significant improvements in fatigue pretty quickly if we see that present. We may also want to look at toxin testing, like HLA, DR, related to mold, TGF, beta 1 related to mold would be good. Starting point tests for toxic burden. And that would be looking for a genetic predisposition and an inflammatory elevation, which could be a cause of migraine headaches and mood swings. Homocysteine would be helpful because that's going to show an idea about methylation status, and low methylation can lead to higher migraine headaches. We could look at something like tryptase, plasma, histamine, and chromogranin A if we're wanting to assess for mast cell activation syndrome and or histamine issue. An alternative to that would be, you know, we could do the advanced intestinal barrier assessment through Dunwoody, and that's going to give us a histamine and DAO levels. So the diamine oxidase enzyme that breaks histamine down, and that'll give us a sense of the degree to which histamine may be playing a role in the migraine headaches and fatigue and mood swings. Chronic infection testing might be helpful. This is, you know, Lyme, co-infections, etc. I know a lot of people aren't going to, you know, want to go there right away. Hypothyroid isn't necessarily going to be caused by Lyme, but moon swings are a common symptom of Lyme and or one of the co-infections. Migraine headaches can be a symptom associated with that. So it's on the table as a possibility. You may not want to go there right out of the gate, but I would have that on the back burner as a possibility for the future. And of course, gut testing, because gut issues can be associated with fatigue, thyroid issues, mood swings, migraine headaches, all of that. And we see hypothyroid associated often with SIBO or H. pylori. So be sure to get a stool test that includes H. pylori, like the GI map, or if you get a doctor's data CDSA, add the H. pylori add-on. Or if you do BioHealth, you can get the 401H, you know, or another one that has H. pylori in it. I think they released a new one recently as well. So that's a bit on lab testing that would be helpful in this case. Also, a NutriVal would be helpful to look at some of the status on nutrients. So we could see, or micronutrient through Vibrant. The nutrients might be helpful to see if some of this, like, is vitamin B6 deficient? Is that contributing to mood swings? Is zinc deficient? Might B2 be a little deficient, contributing to migraine headaches? Might some of the energy producing or ATP cycle be contributing to fatigue? So that would be helpful as well. So I know that's a lot, but, you know, start somewhere. Maybe start with gut testing and then anti-parietal cell antibodies, and maybe HLA-DR and TGF-beta-1, or maybe homocysteine. Start with a few of those and get a general sense, and then you can look to some of the other ones as well, depending on what you find and what the person's lab budget is. Then when we're looking at treatment for symptoms, so directly we can look at the something like vitamin B6, which might be related to mood swings, zinc, a B complex, which could help energy and could help the thyroid function as well, a mineral complex that could be helpful for some of those things, and a vitamin B2 at high dose, like 400 milligrams per day. And specifically, we could do the P5P form of vitamin B6, 50 milligrams once daily. We could do a methylated form of B complex, something like B active by Zymogen, one cap once daily with meals. And then we could do a multi-mineral, something like Minrex would be good, one cap twice daily with meals. And then we could do vitamin B2, sometimes also called riboflavin, 400 milligrams once daily. Now, if you find it in 100 milligrams, you can take two caps twice daily or take 100 divided into four doses. That's probably better for bioavailability. But there is a single one cap 400 milligram dose, which sometimes is better for supplement tolerance, depending on what's the major thing for that person. So these would be sort of for symptoms, but also potentially helpful for getting at some of the root causes. It'd be a little bit of guesswork without lab testing, but it would be covering our bases in terms of the B complex and the minerals for nutrients that the thyroid needs and nutrients that might be involved in mood and nutrients that would support methylation for migraine headaches. We might go further if we're, you know, determining that methylation is a big focus. Like, let's say we do a homocysteine that comes back at 13 or 15. So we know methylation is a focus. So we definitely want the methylated form of B complex, like B active, at one cap once daily. We could even consider one cap twice daily on that. But in addition to that, we also will want to look at choline, and we could look at phosphatidylcholine. So we could look at PC form is a nice form, and we could get that through lecithin, like sunflower lecithin, or we could get that direct through a liquid phosphatidylcholine extract, like Quicksilver makes one, and there's one through Zymogen, and there's one through BioBody. So there are a couple different ways to get phosphatidylcholine, but maybe about, you know, 700 to 1500 milligrams per day would be helpful on the methylation side of things, because so homocysteine can go straight to methionine and bypass methylation products through the utilization of choline. So that's an important nutrient that often goes missing. The dietary front, you can get it through egg yolks and liver. So egg yolks and liver are going to be potentially good sources of choline and other nutrients as well. And then optionally, we could do creatine 5 grams once daily to spare SAMe, because a lot of the SAMe converts to creatine. So you can actually increase SAMe by giving creatine. It's a lot less expensive. You get a side benefit of reducing depression, and also, so we may have some mood benefit there. And we may also, and you could do this from SAMe directly. We could do SAMe 400 milligrams once daily if the powder is not going to be tolerated or the person is able to easily afford SAMe. So we might use SAMe or creatine for that purpose. And then E5P, 50 milligrams once daily, may also help, again, because homocysteine can go down to the sulfation pathway through a cofactor vitamin B6. And then lastly, glycine acts as a methyl buffer. We might do 3 grams three times daily. We want that because we don't want them over methylating, and that can cause its own mood dysregulation. So we want that methyl buffer that's not going to push methylation low if it's normal or already low, but that will lower it if it becomes excessive. So we'd look at that in terms of the methylation cycle. Also, Jen's bringing up a point about the HPA axis for this case, since she has young kids. And we saw six or seven out of 10 in terms of stress levels. So absolutely HPA axis would be significant and would be fuel on the fire for any other causes. So if we find toxins, if we find a gut issue, stress would be fuel on the fire. And we could absolutely directly test for adrenal. So we might look at Dutch complete or plus would be a nice test to have in the mix here. We could also look at an AM cortisol and a DHEAS in the blood. And we can also proactively talk through lifestyle strategies that we might as well do anyway, because clearly she's not taking a lot of care of herself. Self-care is probably lacking. So we want some self-care strategies. And so an honest, open discussion about, hey, I get it, you're busy. I know you're not attending to yourself as much as your kids. I know it might be hard to find time away from the kids. And I'm wondering if you might have some ability to hire a babysitter, have a friend or family member step in and allow you to have some self-care time, even if that's just an hour in an Epsom salt bath, or even just 10 minutes uninterrupted meditation daily. These kinds of things can be really helpful. So we want to look at meditation, breathing, baths, and general self-care things, strategies. So these are things that we want to look at on the lifestyle front, as well as, of course, movement and fitness, because mitochondrial function might be declining and contributing to fatigue, especially with serving little kids if movement and fitness are inadequate. Remember, movement and fitness are one of the big stimulators of mitochondrial biogenesis and are going to be one of the major things that are going to be helpful for general long-term cellular energy. So consider movement and fitness in the context of lifestyle to get some idea on how that's doing and whether that might be playing a role. Then you know, we could look at general proactive detoxification. We could look at a few other things here, but I think this is pretty comprehensive. Since you're just starting to work with her, you might have some opportunities to do some lab testing, to get some additional information. And that can guide things, because, you know, if histamine's an issue, that's its own whole conversation. If toxic burden's an issue, that's its own whole conversation. If there are nutrient deficiencies, we'd like to go over that lab and talk through that. So hopefully this gives you a clear place to get started and a sense for how to move forward with this case in terms of next steps, both things that you can implement right away, as well as tests to assess for further information that might be helpful. Next. Okay, 63-year-old female, fatigue and weakness, onset 2014, but symptoms have been creeping in. Was working too much at the time. Also, time of menopause was around 2014. Okay, so onset of fatigue and weakness came around the onset of menopause, and that was in 2014, and it's been a slow progression. There's also stress as a role, was working too much at the time. Energy crashes between meals, so there may be some hypoglycemia present, but also can't tell when she's hungry, and then she'll suddenly be crashing. And the crash is described as physical weakness, clumsiness, emotionally drained. Feels like she wants to die. When I first started seeing her in June, daily tasks like taking a shower were unmanageable. She's improved since then. Okay, good. So she's on the mend. Past traumas as child, PTSD. So we have some adverse childhood experiences. We know from ACE studies that that can play a role. So we may want to have her do some limbic retraining of some sort, meditation or another limbic retraining system may be incredibly important in her case. She's an energy healer herself, works with healing crystals, and has been working with energy healers for years. Feels that aspect is covered and looking for more physical connections. Drinks 25% caffeine coffee. Not sure if that means 25% caffeinated and 75% decaf, or if it means the coffee has 25% caffeine, which I don't think is possible. So it probably means a quarter caffeinated, three quarters decaf. Daily sugar habit for after a meal with dark chocolate, 88%. Feels she needs both to function throughout the day. So she needs the coffee and the chocolate to function throughout the day. Yeah, 25% caffeinated, 75% decaf has been confirmed. Works too much, running a small business, doesn't feel she has options to scale back or hire help. Effects to balance blood sugar through diet and supplements have helped keep her steady, though if she strays, she crashes. Also recommended liver supportive foods and castor oil packs, preliminary liver supplements. Recently testing Dutch lab work, collation spreadsheet from 2000 to present sense. We have some Dutch work that we'll go over. Also have a GI effect showed general dysbiosis, overgrowth of commensals, low short chain fatty acids, history of constipation, recently recommended colonics with a closed gravity system. She is not tolerating to microbial symptoms were fatigue and pain. Did not recommend SIBO tests since she's not stable enough to fast. Low thyroid pattern on Dutch, serum levels slightly suboptimal. Low MCH and MCHC with low normal hemoglobin, so added iron. Also low androgens, DHEA has helped slightly. Rising A1C, decreasing fasting insulin. She is diabetic or approaching. If so, what follow-up testing for diabetes recommended? Believe her liver and gut need more support as well as the HPA axis. So I'm wondering if there's a larger disease process at play. Current protocol, we have a lozenge. I'm guessing that's deglycerinated licorice, maybe. An adrenal complex. We have hydrochloric acid. We have osteoforce for osteoporosis. Oh, B12 is the lozenge. Okay. So B12 lozenge, adrenal complex, hydrochloric acid, osteoforce, magnesium, calm, short-term for constipation, CoQ10 ubiquinol, chromium synergy, vital zymes, DHEA, 25 milligrams, silymarin, pure encapsulations, which is a milk thistle extract, N-acetylcysteine for detoxification, I'm presuming, thyroid 32.5, three twice a day, berberine complex, it looks like, I'm not sure. I think they may have two versions, a straight berberine and a berberine complex, cod liver oil, the Icelandic Garden of Life repair vite, and iron extra. And we have C serum levels, including glucose markers and its berberine complex for glucose. Okay, so let's look here. And see, we have blood work here. So we have a history of glucose, cholesterol, triglycerides, HDL, LDL, some fasting insulin, red blood cells, hematocrit, estradiol, progesterone, FSH, et cetera. Okay, so if we start with cholesterol levels, we're kind of in the sometimes fairly high, like the 242, sometimes completely normal, like the 184. Triglycerides have been staying under 100, which is great. Most recently, it looks like cholesterol's been about 226 total with 73 HDL. So that's reasonable HDL total ratio, just above 3.1. LDL 144, 121, 105. It's possible the ApoB is a little high there. We'd have to see an ApoB or an LDL particle count. That may be some degree of a concern, although I know it's not chief complaint in this case. Glucose levels, we had 90, 93, 91, 88, 90. So it hasn't crept above 100, but we do have hemoglobin A1C that's hit 6.0. With fasting insulin, 4.7 and 3.7. So fasting insulin is still fairly optimal. Hemoglobin A1C has some problems with it. And there are some tabs on here too. Okay, so we'll get some additional info from the tabs. On the blood sugar front, hemoglobin A1C has a couple of problems with it. Those problems include that different people's blood cells live for different amounts of time. And if the blood cells are living for a long time, then we may have hemoglobin A1C levels that are falsely elevated. It depends if they're living too short or too long as to whether it'll show false elevation or false lowering. But there are a few genetic variations and a few issues that would lead to hemoglobin A1C being unreliable. So when we have a glucose and a fasting insulin and they both look good like they do in this case, now, you know, the fasting glucose could lower a bit. It could be, you know, in the 75 to 85 optimal range for functional. But at a 90, that's not bad. And especially with a 3.7 fasting insulin, that looks to me to be someone who's mindful about carbohydrates and whose blood sugar response may be totally reasonable. Although we did have a 5.5 hemoglobin A1C previously, so we know it has the capacity to be lower. But the way that we're wanting to approach this is to not necessarily assume that blood sugar is a problem here that's significant. The way to tell, the ideal way to tell would be an oral glucose tolerance test with fasting insulin at 2 hours, not fasting, but postprandial insulin at 2 hours. That can be done. It's not too hard to get it done. There are doctor's offices that will do it. Not every doctor's office will, because a person has to be in the office for 2 hours. They take the glucose, they do a test right away fasting, they drink the glucose solution, they do a test at an hour, then they do a test at 2 hours. Ideally, we also get an insulin at one of those times. So oral glucose tolerance testing would reveal a little bit more. She could also just get a glucometer and do some postprandial testing and prick her finger and look 1 hour after a meal and 2 hours after a meal. She's less than 140 an hour after and less than 120 2 hours after. It's a pretty good blood sugar response. And if she can repeat that for most every meal over a few days' time or a week time, then I wouldn't concern myself too much with blood sugar work outside of dietary modification to make sure that dietary values aren't becoming excessively elevated. Now, when we're thinking about fatigue onset around the onset of menopause, we have to think about hormones in relation. It looks like she's been doing some estrogen either through sublingual or patch, as well as testosterone and progesterone. But then she stopped testosterone. That was 2018, though, so that's not around the onset. The onset was more in 2014. So although menopausal timing, yeah, and the HRT has had little or no impact. So we're not really seeing that the hormone cause, even though there was a sense of that timing being related, the hormone replacement didn't seem to help. So we're not thinking that's a primary root cause in her case, although we will potentially think through some other things based on this lab work around adrenals, HPA axis, et cetera. So in terms of the glucose, ideally we'd get an oral glucose tolerance test here, and that would be revealing a little bit more around the degree to which there is an issue on the glucose side of things. But I think berberine's a reasonable solution because it might also help get this cholesterol picture looking a little better in some cases. And it might also help with underlying gut dysfunction if present. So I still think that's a reasonable thing to have her on. When we look at thyroid testing, we have TSH that has been hanging in the 0.5 to 2.5 range, which is optimal. We have no antibodies to speak of, but we do have thyroglobulin tumor marker S that came up. We have T4 totals that look normal. We have free T4 that got a smidge low here, but has come up. Reverse T3 started to creep up a little bit up here early, but later has gotten better. T3 uptake, we had total T3, and she was on 5 micrograms, it looks like. And then T3 free, 2.5, 2.72, 2.53, and then 3.16 when not on T3 for 6 months. That's actually really good that the free T3 went up and the reverse is reasonable. So 3.16 is in that optimal place. 2.5 is the lowest we want to see it. Better if it's 3 to 4. And it had been in the past and it wasn't. Now it is. So thyroid looks to be in reasonably good shape at this point, except for the tumor marker. Not on T3 for 6 months. So that's thyroid. Blood cells. Okay, red blood cells, hemoglobin, hematocrit. White blood cells are kind of low normal. Lymphocytes, monocytes are in a reasonable ratio with each other. Neutrophils should be about twice lymphocytes. We do see that's generally the case. Eosinophils, basophils, okay. Now let's look at the other Dutch . So Jen's asking, does the A1C represent the blood sugar swings she feels daily and has so much difficulty controlling? wondering about the relationship between low blood sugar symptoms with elevated glucose on lab. It's very common to have low blood sugar symptoms with elevated glucose because what happens is glucose tends to spike up and then the body tries to compensate because it gets so high that it overcompensates and brings it low, which is why you get things like diabetic reactive hypoglycemia and potentially even diabetic coma is because of those swings high-low. It's almost like if the blood sugar gets too high and the body's been unable to control it, the body opens the floodgates to lower to a significant degree as quickly as possible the blood sugar and may overshoot and get it too low and may lead to experiencing hypoglycemia. So that's why we can see average blood sugar high but low blood sugar symptoms. The A1C does not represent the blood sugar swing so much as it represents the average over the past 2 to 3 months. But if we do want to look at swings, there are a couple of ways to do that. One is to look at a fructosamine or glycated serum protein, which are the same, and that looks for a spike in the past couple weeks. So that would be a reasonable marker to get is a fructosamine marker to look for a spike high in the past couple of weeks. Lactate dehydrogenase or LDH is a reasonable marker to look for low blood sugar. That's not directly what it's measuring, but when it's low, it can be an indirect indicator of low blood sugar. So that's a reasonable one to look for an average low blood sugar. In this case, I think a fructosamine and then an oral glucose tolerance test would be more telling. So I would look for those because if we see on an oral glucose tolerance test that it spikes way up 290 at the 1 hour mark, then we're really concerned, or even if she just does her own postprandial glucose after or postprandial finger prick glucose tests post meal at an hour and it's 190, 200, that's going to potentially be an issue. Now, you know, one strategy around blood sugar regulation in a case like this is delay mealtime to if she would normally eat in 10 minutes or 15 minutes, have her eat over an hour period of time when she can, so that she can have a slower release of glucose from the meal if she is spiking and going low. So, of course, the French are famous for their 2 hour dinners and lots of courses, and there are other cultures that do similar. And that may be helpful in some cases to stabilize blood sugar. Okay, now we're looking at Dutch results and we're seeing that this is from September 2019. Progesterone was robust, estrogen was starting to get low, testosterone low. This may be a robust progesterone due to hormone replacement therapy is my guess. And maybe she had stopped the testosterone replacement but was doing progesterone and estradiol, which is why she's not in the postmenopausal range, which is the 0.3 to 2.0 for progesterone and the 0.2 to 0.7 for estradiol. We do see elevation in the HPA axis with that high free cortisol on the first two, high normal on the third, and then low at night, crashes at night, but overall free cortisol being high, but total metabolized cortisol being low. So it means the portion of free is extreme for the portion of total. So that thyroid supplementation that you started may bring that metabolized cortisol up, but there also needs to be some effort to bring the free cortisol pattern down most likely in this case. So we may want either meditation practice, breathing practice, stress-reducing activities, and or phosphatidylserine, magnolia, Sisyphus. These are things that might be helpful in bringing some of that free cortisol level down. I mean, it might change as the total goes up, as to how much portion of it's going to be free, but it would be worth some experimentation with adaptogenic herbs and other things that might be able to, especially lifestyle things that might be able to help bring those cortisol levels down. I like to go straight down and just make sure creatinine levels are normal, which they are, so that's good. The androsterone is low normal, so on the androgenic side of things, we're low normal, if anything. So that makes sense with the DHEA, 25 milligram supplementation. You could even do 25 milligrams twice a day and test and see how she feels. Oh, she has a great meditation practice. Good. So if she has a great meditation practice, she may want to either extend the sit times, sit more than once per day, or she may want to add a breathing practice or another perspective on top of the meditation practice to help with those cortisol levels. And she was on both estradiol and progesterone at the time of this test. Okay, so we see the estrone is in the postmenopausal range, but the estradiol, estriol are higher. And we see the breakdown looks a little low on the 2-OH and higher on the 16-OH breakdown of estrogen, and then low on the methylation side. And so here we do want to look at overall methylation, and in particular vitamin B6, so P5P, as well as a B complex. So methylation would be a focus here to see if that might be playing a role. Then melatonin looked fairly robust, so that's good. Total DHEA, metabolized cortisol low, we knew those. We saw this pattern already. So then we look at methylmalonate. That came in at 1.6, and that's within range, so that's good. The vitamin B6 markers, because, you know, I'm thinking vitamin B6 might be a part of the methylation side, although these markers did come up normal, not even borderline. So on these urinary byproducts, these might be suggestive that we don't want to go super high just on vitamin B6, but we may want to give general methylation support and look at a B complex, maybe some choline, maybe some creatine or SAMe. Glutathione and some glycine as a buffer. Glutathione came within range, well, pyroglutamate, which can indicate dysfunction in glutathione if low or high. And the neurotransmitter markers came up within range, and the oxidative stress marker came up within range. So overall, fairly reasonable picture. It's showing some HPA axis dysregulation as the primary issue, a little bit of methylation issue as well, and low androgen. So in this case, I think we're on the right track with giving DHEA. We could try increasing it to twice per day as an option to see if she feels better and notices improvement, and that may help with the androgens as well. I think we're on the right track with berberine, just because even if the blood sugar isn't a concern, it may help on the gut side of things. And you mentioned that she didn't tolerate many antimicrobials, but if she is tolerating berberine, we're at least getting some antimicrobial activity from that. We may want to look at other antimicrobial strategies. I've dealt with people who haven't tolerated them well. And one strategy is to add immunoglobulin together with antimicrobials. So to take serum bovine immunoglobulin SBI, or to take colostrum, or to take the IgY, the IG26 by Zymogen, the egg immunoglobulin. because some of the mechanism of action for immunoglobulins is actually to bind to lipopolysaccharide and to some of the byproducts for bacteria that might be causing symptoms like fatigue and pain. So there may be an endotoxin die-off reaction to antimicrobials, and that might be reduced or eliminated through simultaneous administration of antimicrobials together with immunoglobulin to bind up some of that endotoxin. Also, I'll mention that there is a breathing technique called Wim Hof Method. And Wim Hof Method has an app and it's free. And that method specifically has been researched to eliminate endotoxin from the body quickly. So there may also be the ability to do Wim Hof Method breathing prior to, or right after, actually better an hour after antimicrobial administration. Usually people do it on an empty stomach. So you could do it if you apply antimicrobials 30 minutes before a meal. You could then do the breathing and then take the meal. I would say even if it's after the meal on a full stomach, still the breathing might be worthwhile to do to clear endotoxin from the blood. So I would recommend looking at Wim Hof Method breathing for helping to reduce the endotoxin that might be part of the reason for not tolerating antimicrobials. So Wim Hof Method has a free app. It's a breathing technique, and it's deep inhales and natural exhales for 30 to 40 breaths, followed by exhale and hold, ideally 1 to 3 minute hold out. App can time retention time so that you can have a record of that. And researched for clearing endotoxin. So they injected this guy with LPS. Most people got sick. He did the breathing. He did not. Everyone else did. He taught other people to do the breathing. They did not get sick, but non-breathing technique people did. So very effective for reducing endotoxin quickly, but people have to actually do it. And they have to time it where if they're feeling a little bit ill after an antimicrobial, they want to do the endo, they want to do the breathing. And ideally, they want to do the breathing before they feel ill or off. But if they haven't, or if they did, but they're still feeling ill or off, do it again. So immunoglobulin can be combined. So we can do, you know, options for antimicrobials would be combine with immunoglobulin, combine with Wim Hof breathing would be options to be able to tolerate antimicrobials. And for immunoglobulins, yes, you would take at the same time as the antimicrobials, or just after the antimicrobials. Either way would be fine. You're just trying to mop up the endotoxin release that's happening as the antimicrobials interact with the with the microbes themselves. And the other thing you can do on endotoxin reactivity is you can do a while on liver detoxification and NRF2 upregulators and then go back to antimicrobials later. So you could add some DIM, like some nanoemulsified DIM, or on top of your NAC and silymarin that you're doing, and or curcumin and or green tea or any of the NRF2 upregulators, and you could do that for a little while and then come back to antimicrobials. You can also cycle through different antimicrobials. So, you know, let's say oil of oregano is not tolerated, you might try peppermint oil GI, which has peppermint oil and ginger. Sometimes that's better tolerated. In some cases, you might try biocidin, and there's the LSF, which is liposomal, or the regular drops. You might try biocidin to see if that is better tolerated, and you can start really slow because it's drops. So you can start one drop once a day, one drop twice a day for a few days, then two drops once, one drop once for a few days, or one drop three times a day, depending on if people do two or three times a day dosing, and so on and so forth, and build up until a point that a person can tolerate. If they get a die-off reaction, go back down one dose. So if they're at 10 drops total in the day and they get a die-off, go back to 9 drops and stay there for a week. So you can use that kind of strategy with liquid products like biocidin fairly easily. And that can be a way to get tolerance for antimicrobials. Sometimes lorazepam works when something like oil of oregano does not. In some cases, I've found maybe gentler in certain ways. And berberine products, which you've already done, can be helpful. And it sounds like she's tolerating them. So that's great on the antimicrobial front. And then you can look at probiotics as well that have some antibiotic constituents to them, like spore-based probiotics. And so those actually have antimicrobial components to them. So that might be another way to get some antimicrobial activity in someone who's typically being sensitive to antimicrobials, and that may be helpful in this case. So I would say it would also be helpful to recommend DNRS, which is the dynamic neural retraining, I believe is the system, is the acronym. And that is DNRS is going to help retrain the limbic system. And since there's history of trauma here, this may be a very helpful system that's different from just meditation, that may work synergistically together with meditation. So I would look at the DNRS system as another suggestion in this particular case for a way to help her with working through some of the reactivity as well. In some cases, mast cell activation syndrome can be involved in reactivity. So I'm just going to put histamine and or MCAS question mark as a possible exploration to think about in this case, just because there may be that issue leading to hyperreactivity, and we've seen that in some cases. Another thing to consider in this case is low-dose immunotherapy or low-dose allergy therapy. And sometimes I think it may be antigen. And these are going to be almost like homeopathic doses to build immune tolerance. And the histamine is related more to the hypersensitivity of supplements. I have seen it go together with low blood sugar, and subjectively one client, I don't know of any research that correlates that, but there is low methylation correlation with high histamine. And we did see that little bit of evidence on the Dutch around low methylation of estrogen. So it may be that there is a histamine issue and or mast cell activation syndrome, and we see hypersensitivity to antimicrobials sometimes coming together with histamine issues. Christina has someone who reacts to one drop of biocidin. Can they try to remove endotoxins with Wim Hof only? Also reacts to spore-based probiotics. So in a person like that, we might think of some similar suggestions. DNRS, which is Dynamic Neural Retraining System, would be helpful potentially in that individual. Even someone who reacts to one drop, you can mix one drop into 2 ounces of water and drink 1 ounce of it and get half a drop. So you can, you know, get a half a drop, get a quarter drop, and try and find that threshold for what a person tolerates. So you can do that. You could look at low-dose immunotherapy or low-dose antigen therapy. I mean, yes, Wim Hof would be potentially really helpful and can clear endotoxin without any supplement whatsoever, but it may not clear a gut infection. Even though to clear endotoxin, it may not clear the gut infection. I don't know. There's no research on that. It probably helps with autoimmune disease. They're running a clinical trial on rheumatoid arthritis. The results aren't in yet, but it may help with autoimmune diseases. Whether it helps with a gut infection, we don't know at this point. But it'd be worth giving it a shot for sure. When someone's sensitive to supplements, we want to look at what options do we have. But DNRS would be an option. Low-dose immunotherapy or low-dose antigen therapy might be an option. Wim Hof breathing would certainly be an option. And then potentially trying some other antimicrobials. Just because someone reacts to one does not mean they will react to them all. So maybe they'll tolerate berberine. Maybe they'll tolerate lauricide. Maybe they'll tolerate peppermint oil GI. Maybe they'll tolerate Alamed. So, you know, Alamed is from garlic. It's, you know, sometimes food-based things like that are a little better for certain people. So we might, you know, see how they do with a high-dose garlic extract like Alamed. Even if they could just tolerate one cap once per day of Alamed, that would be a pretty significant antimicrobial. So that would be something to take a look at for a person. So those are some of the strategies that might be helpful in this particular case. And you know, in this case, and actually in the last case where fatigue was significant, I would look at a nocturnal oximetry or home sleep study. You can refer them to Vivos is a good place. And that will take a look at jaw structure, give some oxygen levels at night, and get a sense for whether fatigue may be caused in part by low oxygen at night or sleep apnea. So I would recommend a nocturnal oximetry or home sleep study for this and for the last case that we were talking about with sleep issues and fatigue being significant. I think that's a really important one to screen for and have people take a look at, because it's more common than you might think. Even people who aren't overweight or drinking a lot of alcohol, which are things that can cause sleep apnea. Sometimes it's just a simple jaw structure issue. So that'd be worthwhile doing some testing around that. Let's see what else. She had low short chain fatty acids. So I would consider butyrate supplementation about maybe 1.2 gram per day, once or twice per day. That'll help with a temporary boost on the short chain fatty acids while getting work on the underlying gut dysfunction. And yes, even if she sleeps well, I would still get nocturnal oximetry, because some people sleep extremely well and it's hard for them to wake up, even because they're not getting enough oxygen and they need more sleep. They're not getting restful sleep. They're sort of like 8 hours is only producing the oxygen that another person who got 6 hours would produce. So sometimes it can go with hypersomnia. Back to glucose, is it possible for A1C to be high and the insulin to be optimal? Could the high cortisol cause some of the high A1C? So it is possible for A1C to be high and insulin to be optimal. And it is possible that that means that blood sugar on average is high. Fasting insulin will not always catch high blood sugar issues. In fact, some blood sugar issues are correlated with low insulin, but that's usually later stage diabetes or type 1 diabetes. So you can't necessarily look at those two in conjunction to each other. There are ratios between glucose and insulin that are trying to detect insulin resistance. But A1C being high and insulin being optimal is not necessarily telling one way or another about blood sugar. High cortisol could cause high A1C because it can cause elevations in blood sugar in general. So cortisol can stimulate gluconeogenesis that can lead to overall high blood sugar. Hemoglobin A1C would be a measurement of that high blood sugar on average, and the fasting glucose may not be reflecting that, and you don't have to have it reflect that. You may see normal fasting glucose or high normal fasting glucose and still have a blood sugar issue that's high. But because A1C, I've seen it be fluky enough times, I really would want to see a postprandial glucose response before I'd be thinking anything in the line of prediabetes in this case. I really want to see at least her get a glucometer for herself and do 1 and 2 hour postprandial, post-meal blood sugar testing before I'm going to be convinced that blood sugar is a significant issue in her case. So I would recommend 1 hour and 2 hour postprandial or an oral glucose tolerance test or both. Looking for less than 140 at 1 hour and less than 120 at 2 hours. D do this for several meals over a week's time to kind of get an average sense. And you may find that the blood sugar response is quite good, but you may find that it's an issue. So, you know, this is more the gold standard. Oral glucose tolerance test or 1 or 2 hour postprandial is more the gold standard than fasting glucose, hemoglobin A1C. So if you have reason to suspect or there's weird contradictory findings, this is the way to start to clear up what's happening on the blood sugar side of things. And then if you're still struggling after doing all of that, then you want to look a little deeper into toxin issues, you know, toxins, chronic infections. Okay, how to determine inflammatory process causing pain, specifically in joints, female, 60 years old, joint pain, hands, feet, knees, affects mobility, makes doing daily tasks difficult, hands appear swollen, inflamed, stiff. Seem well-adjusted, happily married, very positive mindset, determined to get better, does have siblings with autoimmune, but no diagnosis herself. Does not want to take medication to cover up symptoms, wants to know the cause, willing to do whatever she needs to fix it. Initial testing indicated dysbiosis, CRP 4.37, it's definitely inflammation. Homocysteine 8.0, a little high, 7 or less is better. So a little bit of methylation issue. Normal cortisol, low DHEA. So DHEA supplementation has been shown to help autoimmune disease, especially at higher doses like 50 milligrams per day. So I would look at DHEA 25 milligrams twice a day, especially if we're suspecting autoimmune. We see family history of autoimmune. We don't know if she has it yet, but it would be worth considering. In a 6-month wellness plan, first 60 days, did GI work, food elimination, detox, noticed her knees were a little better, mind cleared, but hands and feet still stiff. Have used Omegas, Curcumin ongoing, and Wobenzyme Plus, no change in feet and hand pain and stiffness. Most recently have added Celoxacin, Proteozyme, and Synovex recovery to the Curcuplex and Monopure 1300. So that's fish oil and some joint things. I believe there's some Boswellia and some proteolytic enzymes there. Been off sugar, gluten, dairy, nightshades, and pork for 5 months. Need help determining root causes and additional approaches for relief. Additionally, she discovered a topical concoction of cod liver oil with essential oils helpful to ease symptoms. So we're really looking at inflammatory process causing pain, specifically in joints. We have hsCRP elevated. That's obviously an inflammatory marker. What I'm curious about is, have we retested hsCRP? And if so, has it changed? And if so, in what direction and to what degree? There's a lot of good things happening here. It looks like, you know, omegas and curcumin and Wobenzyme. And then there's been added some additional anti-inflammatory molecules here like Boswellia and additional enzymes. But we need to figure out a little bit more potentially the root cause for why the inflammation. Could it have been the dysbiosis and the CRP is back to normal? And there's some lingering arthritis. Could it be rheumatoid in nature? These are the kinds of questions I'm curious about. So let's pull open a whiteboard here. So we have joint pain / inflammation, elevated HSCRP, slightly elevated homocysteine, dysbiosis. So questions, has HSCRP been retested? Has it changed? We want to see it less than one. The lower the better. Has RF and anti-CCP3 been tested? If not, consider testing to identify whether this might be rheumatoid arthritis. And there is a dysbiosis link to the root cause for why CCP3 antibodies form, depending on what kind of dysbiosis and what test you've had. We may be able to look at some of that bacteria. So you know, if you have the testing that could potentially be helpful on the dysbiosis front to see what things might be elevated and see if we can make a link between some of those things. But this is some additional testing that could be helpful. And then it seems like there's been some change in pain overall. So there are a few things that we can look at here. So one thing is that CBD may be helpful in this case. And OHI makes a water soluble CBD with about 20x bioavailability. The problem with CBD is it's hard to get the dose right because all the animal research uses milligrams per kilogram to get effectiveness that would equate in humans to be like insane doses, like 30, 50 milligrams, which would be like a whole bottle of most things. And that's extremely expensive and untenable usually by people. So we need a form that's more highly bioavailable to approach closer to the researched levels of CBD, and OHI Energetics makes a water-soluble CBD that has 20 times bioavailability. So that's a good one to get. 3 to 6 droppers, loading dose first day, and then 1 to 2 droppers maintenance after that. And the bottle comes with dosing instructions, and there's some art to that. So have people read those and follow those dosing instructions. And there's some things where the taste changes from bitter to sweet, and that can be an indication you're getting closer to a nice, helpful threshold point. But then you might have to go over a threshold back to bitter and then sweet again if your primary concern hasn't been achieved or reached by the first threshold. So CBD might be a really helpful thing in this case to look at in conjunction with getting to the root cause, but, you know, for especially temporary relief. And there might be, you know, some benefit to oral, some benefit to topical. We do want to kind of get a sense for, is this more autoimmune in nature, or is it more, you know, arthritis in nature? I'll say that for autoimmune, we could look at the DHEA 25 milligrams twice a day can be really helpful for autoimmune patterns. We may also want to look at some additional, I know there was evidence of dysbiosis and there was some gut work, but possible gut retesting and additional gut work. And that could be in the form of small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. If that hasn't been tested for and treated, that could be in the form of an additional cycle of antimicrobials and then gut repair supplements. That can look a few different ways, but gut is so key and central in autoimmune disease that it's well worth revisiting it and covering it in great detail. Immunoglobulins are often very helpful, sometimes during gut treatment, sometimes after, sometimes both. And those are helpful with restoring the gut lining. So immunoglobulins, SBI Protect or IG26 or IG2000 are all going to be good options for immunoglobulins that can be helpful, especially with autoimmune disease, if that's what's going on here. And then covering the bases on B vitamins and minerals is just going to be helpful for overall physiologic functioning and cofactors for all sorts of enzymes that are involved in maintaining healthy tissue in the body. So those are going to be important as well to address. Then joint pain can be caused by certain kinds of toxic burden and chronic infections. So, you know, if not getting results from this first round, consider toxic burden like from mold and or chronic infection like Lyme. So you might start to ask for, have you been exposed to mold toxin any time in your life? Have you been bitten by a tick? And you might start to get a sense for, you know, are you living in a potentially moldy environment? Has there been water damage? And don't believe people on their first time because they may not know. 1 in 2 American homes is water damaged. So, you know, you can look at some binders for mold toxin, and there are lots that we can do if we know mold is an issue or Lyme is an issue. So you can look at a tick-borne panel from Vibrant America or DNA Connections, or you can look at Igenics for Lyme testing. For toxic burden for mold, a simple LabCorp test for HLA, DR, DQ, genetics, the 167120 is the CPT code for HLA, DR through LabCorp, and then the TGF beta 1, so human transforming growth factor beta 1, is another inflammatory marker that if elevated could be a cause for why we're seeing pain still in this case, in which case we'd be looking at reducing toxin as a prime target. Of course, in the meanwhile, you can always do some general NRF2 support and or some glutathione, some N-acetylcysteine, and you could also try some Optifiber Lean as a binder or activated charcoal or microchitosan as options for getting started with some binding or chlorella that could be sort of tells in a way. If they're successful and she's noticing improvement, that might indicate a little bit that we're moving in the right direction with binding toxin. So those would all be things to take a look at. And, you know, if there's mold toxin burden in the body, that's going to not get better with other stuff. So, you know, it's kind of something that you can get to if you're not getting initial results by adding in the DHEA and by adding in the CBD and by doing more gut work, then you may look at toxic burden and or chronic infection. All righty. So I hope this has been helpful for everyone. And keep the questions coming. This was great. We had several case studies and I did see some, I did see a Dutch lab that was uploaded that I did not review because I wasn't sure who it was connected to. I'm looking at it now and it does look like it may have been connected to the 37-year-old that we did a case study with. I think we got most of the information that we needed from the submission. But if you do upload a lab that's connected with a submission, please do mention in the submission that you have uploaded a lab or that you will be uploading a lab connected with it, just so that I know to go looking for that specifically tied to and correlated with that case. So thank you all so much for a great question and answer. Hope you guys have a great evening and we'll be in touch soon. Keep submitting great questions. Have a great evening.